Lucky Strike presents Your Hit Parade, starring Frank Sinatra.
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men?
And now, smile a while with Lorenzo Jones and his wife, Belle.
Manhattan merry-go-round that brings you the bright side of life, that whirls you in music to all the big night spots of New York town, to hear the top songs of the week sung so clearly you can understand every word and sing them yourself.
This is the Golden Age of Radio. I'm Dick Bertel, and tonight we'll take you on another audio excursion back to radio's formative years. You'll hear the programs that made the era golden, and meet people who made those broadcasts a reality.
The Golden Age of Radio is brought to you by Burritt Mutual Savings Bank, serving Central Connecticut since 1889, and by WTIC. You'll meet actor Mason Adams after these words from the Burritt. Do you know how being a preferred borrower at Burritt Mutual Savings Bank can help you? The other day, a man who was waiting in the personal loan department was asked if this was the first time that he had applied for a loan at the Burritt Mutual Savings Bank. No, he said. It was actually the fourth. Why had he come back to the Burritt? Burritt was his bank. The loan officers were friendly and sympathetic to his needs, and they were willing to take the time to discuss his financial problems and help him. The rates are lower, he said. Monthly payments are convenient. And once he had established credit at the Burritt, he had become a preferred borrower, and his loans got top priority. Sounds like a position you would like to be in? Well, if so, drop in at any one of the Burritt Mutual Savings Bank's five convenient offices in New Britain, West Hartford, Rocky Hill, and Glastonbury. You too may become a preferred Burritt borrower. The long-term benefits are tremendous. And now the host of the Golden Age of Radio, Dick Bertel.
Good evening. And with me again, of course, is radio collector Ed Corcoran. And Ed, who's our guest tonight?
Well, tonight, Dick, we have another one of the very famous voices of old-time radio, who was known in them days as Pepper Young.
In them days?
And today is one of the most sought-after commercial producers in the country, Mason Adams, Dick.
Mason, you know, it for our old-time radio listeners, it might be better to introduce you as Pepper Young. Would you feel more at home if I did that?
I would indeed. Pepper Young represented one of the funny quote-unquote jokes, you know, that I always would use, was that Pepper Young was almost became a steady job. I was Pepper for 16 years.
That's a long run for
it
any
was,
program.
But it represented one of the happiest periods of my life, I must say.
Of course, your voice is so familiar to our radio listeners, I know, whether they are fond of old-time radio programs or not, because you do a myriad number of radio and television commercials today. You're more active today, I believe, than you were during the so-called golden days of radio.
Well, I guess I'm heard perhaps as much now as I was then, but not physically as active and as far as recording goes, because we record a commercial and then hopefully it's played again and again and again and again, which is fine. One of the great things about radio was the actual physical activity of doing a show, let's say doing a My True Story in the morning, and then perhaps if one were playing a part on one of the soap operas, Rosemary or When a Girl Marries, and working for an hour and a half, rehearsing an hour and a half, and then doing a 15-minute segment, and then later on in the afternoon doing Pepper Young, and then in the evening doing an Inner Sanctum. So you could literally, you might do four shows in the during the course of one day, going from NBC, one studio on NBC to another, and then perhaps over to 52nd Street to CBS, so that the excitement that was generated by the lots of different activities and roles that one played in radio, that excitement was really quite extraordinary and has never been duplicated in my own experience.
Well, let's see if we can capture some of it tonight. Let's go back to your college days in Wisconsin, first of all. That's where you became enamored of radio, I take it.
Well, I worked in radio. I went was at the university, and I wrote and produced and performed in various radio shows on WHA and enjoyed doing it. But when I left Wisconsin and came back to New York, determined to be an actor, I determined that I'd be a legitimate actor. I thought radio acting was sort of a second-class profession. I came to New York and I taught and I acted a little bit here and there and got over my prejudice against radio very, very quickly and very happily, too. It had a snowball effect, you know. You'd be heard having, somebody would hear you, you know, doing a show here and then call you in and you'd do a Gangbusters, and then somebody would hear you do a Gangbusters and you'd be called in to do an Inner Sanctum. And so it proliferated and spread, and pretty soon one was reasonably active.
Ed, are you just about to let go with perhaps one of the exciting excerpts of the evening? I think that this show, among all the shows that we've played on the air, is my favorite, the suspense series.
Yes, and this one is science fiction. Dick indulges me a bit, lets me play science fiction. That's my my real interest in radio. This is one about a rocket ship that goes into outer space, and this was just at the time when we were starting this program. So this was a fiction writer's concept, what was going to happen, and I thought maybe it'd be interesting to see the story and what it's really all about today.
Another tale well calculated to keep you in suspense.
Well, that's it, Pappy. Everything has been checked and double-checked. Mm-hmm. The X-15's locked in and ready to go. At 0730 hours, Ed here will take off and carry you and your craft to 36,500 feet. Ground control will wait 2 seconds and then ignite your rockets. From then on, you're on your own.
There's no change in aircraft test?
No. Just don't take it more than 100 miles up. All we're interested in this trip is re-entry. And I don't think we'll have any problems there. Uh-huh. Any questions?
No, sir.
Very well, then. I've got to get over to operations or I'll miss the whole show. Good luck to you both. Dr. May, why doesn't he say something? His orders were to talk as much as he can.
Minus 30 seconds to burn out. Give him time. As soon as the rocket motor's cut out, he'll be able to talk. Right now, he's plastered back against his seat with 7 Gs. He feels that if he opens his mouth right now, his jaw will tear off.
Aircraft commander to ground control. He's out of sight now. Both engines fired perfectly, and he climbed upstairs faster than anything I've seen in a lifetime of flying.
Tell Ed a good job. Well done.
Sir, radar reports X-15 on course and climbing steadily.
Take it easy, General. He'll make it.
Yes, I know.
Flame up. X-15, this is ground control. Do you read me? Over. X-15, this is ground control. Do you read me? Over.
Ground control, this is your old Pappy, and I read you just fine. Just fine.
What's the matter with him? He doesn't sound right.
He's completely wakeless now. I think he's experiencing a side effect of exuberance and exhilaration. It's to be expected.
Hello, Pappy. This is General Brighton. Can you read me?
Yes, General. Us chickens hear you loud and clear.
Try to keep us informed as much as possible on your observations and operations.
Pappy, describe the effects of weightlessness. Do you feel nauseated, dizzy?
No, I feel fine. I feel like I'm home for the first time in my life. Like this is where I belong and I want to stay. It's so easy to move. If I want to lift my arm, it jumps up. If I stick it straight out in the air and relax, it stays where I leave it, so I can rest it anywhere I want it. But that isn't the best, Dr. May. Not the best. Oh, you should be up here, Doctor. It's beautiful. It's just beautiful.
What's beautiful?
Space. The threshold of the universe. It's the beginning, Dr. May, and it's the end.
X-15, this is ground control. You have now reached an altitude of 95 miles. Begin re-entry maneuver.
Well, if it's all the same to you, ground control, I've got enough gas. I just think I'll just go a little bit farther.
X-15, you have passed the apex of your flight. Your orders are to level off for re-entry.
But I have to keep going. I'll be back.
What's the matter with him?
Evidently, the aura of well-being that weightlessness produces has given him a dangerous false sense of security. Try giving him a direct order. In this childlike state, he might respond to the first positive suggestion.
X-15, this is General Brighton.
I order you to level off that aircraft and commence the classic re-entry maneuver. Do you read me?
Sir?
That ship is property of the United States government. I order you to level off and return it to this field in accordance with your contract.
But, sir...
Don't argue with me. Bring it down.
Yes, sir.
What's he doing, Radar?
He's leveling off, sir. Now he's beginning the 45-degree angle of re-entry.
Telemetrics, what do you read?
Temperature normal. Pulse normal. Respiration normal.
Radar reports the aircraft has definitely begun the correct angle of re-entry.
Happy. Dr. May again. If it doesn't interfere too much, we would appreciate it if you'd keep giving your sensations and reactions whenever you can during re-entry. It may be important.
All right. When I pushed the nose down, the edge of the earth broke above my instrument panel like the rim of a great sea. A sea that has turned to blue-green mud, covered with a cataract film of clouds. The rivers of lead are beginning to pour through my veins, wading down my arms. It's getting harder to breathe. Sound is beginning to come back. And I feel like I'm turning my back on a new world and re-entering a dead one. Sounds like the plane is falling apart and there are people standing on my wings outside. She's getting difficult to handle. The ship is pitching and yawing as she hits each shock wave of atmosphere. And I can feel it start to heat up. In spite of the air conditioning and insulation, the heat is almost unbearable in here. No!
What's happened?
No! No! I can't!
Happy, do you read me? What's going on out there?
I can't come back to that crumbling world of gravity and death. I can't.
He's
among
the thermal thickets. What's going on out there?
This is where he'll melt apart in midair.
I don't belong down there.
Mad, he's mad. Happy, I order you to fasten your safety harness and bring that ship in.
You can't order me, General. It's getting hotter in here. I have to disconnect this umbilical cord.
Happy, do not disconnect the umbilical cord. You cannot live without it. Right now you think you can, but you cannot. You need the oxygen to breathe.
Happy, that ship is property of the United States government.
The ship is yours. My mind is my own, General. I have to go back while there's still time. While there's still time to disconnect this.
Happy, listen to me. You cannot live without the cord. You need oxygen to live. Happy, for the sake of Aaron and the children, leave the cord alone. Happy, do you hear me? What's the telemetric readings?
They've dropped to normal, sir. Right across the board.
Normal?
Normal, sir. Radar, what's your reading?
Aircraft adhering to the proper 45-degree angle of descent. Losing altitude. At the proper speed.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is your news reporter, Dave Miller. At the moment, I'm standing at the edge of Rogers Dry Lake in the Mojave Desert at Edwards Air Force Base in Southern California. In just a few seconds, if all goes well, a sleek, black, ferrous alloy rocket-propelled aircraft will come hurtling out of the sky from the east, slide across this flat desert at speeds up to 200 miles an hour, and stop just a few yards away from where I'm standing. And then Mr. Howard Pappy Winfield will step from the cockpit and become the first man to have flown into outer space and returned. It is a beautiful day at Edwards Air Force Base. The sun is hot and bright, but there is a prevailing westerly wind. Several men are pointing off to the east, but as yet... Yes, now I see it too. It looks to be hardly bigger than a speck, just a few feet above the horizon. But it's growing bigger all the time. Now we can see it quite clearly. The pilot has jettisoned his ventral stabilizer. This strange, dart-like aircraft has no wheels. It lands on steel skids on its underside. There she's touching down. You can see a cloud of smoke from the floor where she hit. She bounced up. Now she's trying again. This is the ship the newspaper men call the missile with the man in it. And that's exactly what she looks like, a huge black missile with stubby wings. A plume of dust is following her. It decreases as the ship slows down, and it is slowing. In a moment, it will be almost abreast of us. There it is. It is almost stopped. Listen to the cheering of the technicians as they run toward the ship. Now they're moving an aluminum ladder into place next to the ship. Mechanics in asbestos gloves are working to get the canopy raised. The latch is released. Slowly, the canopy is being raised. In just a moment, we catch our first sight of the first man from outer space. If I can just get closer. Ladies and gentlemen. There is no one there. The cockpit is empty.
Suspense.
Well, it's still my favorite series, Suspense. Let's talk about Pepper Young. I'm sure most of our listeners remember this program, if no other show. And you did do the program, or the part, for some 16 years. The show actually had originated before that.
Yes. When Elaine Carrington first wrote the show, it was called Red Adams. And as I understand it, they had to change the name because their sponsor was a chewing gum, was Wrigley's or something like that, and there was an Adams chewing gum, Adams Pepsin or something, you know. Mm-hmm. Elaine Pepper Red, you know, redhead. Pepper Young was a redhead, and she changed it to Pepper Young. Funny thing, the original Pepper Young, the original Red Adams, was Burgess Meredith, and he must have been extraordinary. He was a young actor then who was just beginning to make his mark. One of the great things about Elaine Carrington was that she had a knack for discovering actors and using them. For instance, during the course of Pepper Young, one day a young actor came in named Jason Robards. She had seen Jason in a play off Broadway, had recognized him for the brilliant talent that he was, and he was having a hard time economically then, as so many actors do. His wife was sick, and he needed the bread, like the fella says. And so Elaine Carrington wrote in a part for him for 6 months. And he was, you know, revenue emerged from that. And she would do this all the time. She found somebody that she really liked. She would write a part in for him. Well, and she
marvelous.
Nurtured talents, you know. She was an extraordinary woman. She was a writer. She wrote short stories, and she was published in the Saturday Evening Post and in other slick magazines. This was in the early 30s. Her husband was a lawyer, and like so many other people, it was the middle of the Depression, and they had no money. For whatever reasons, young lawyers were no more earning money than young anything else in those days. And so somebody suggested that she try to write, that she try her hand, perhaps her agent for the short stories, try her hand at writing a short half-hour show for radio, which she did. And out of that evolved the soap opera form. Originally it was, I think, once a week for half an hour, and then NBC asked that she try writing it in 15-minute segments, and she was one of the real pioneers in the field. This was very, very early in the 30s. And from that, of course, came Pepper Young and then Rosemary, When a Girl Marries. Can't remember. She had some other shows as well. She wrote a lot of them, and she wrote them quite extraordinarily. She wrote them with great facility. What she did, she had a dictating machine, and she would dictate into a machine, taking a bath or whatever she was doing, and mm-hmm. dictating another show, you know, as she was doing it. She would do these things and turn them out, keep plots very clearly in mind. And she had some sort of stopwatch somewhere upstairs here that, you know, would just allow her to do as much dialogue as was necessary.
Oh, she would ad-lib the dialogue into the dictating machine.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely, yeah, yeah. So that's one of the ways in which she wrote. She wrote out loud, as it were. But she was an extraordinary lady, and I enjoyed my association with her over many long years.
You know what surprised me? She did not adapt to television as a writer, did she?
No, she tried, but her forte was writing for radio. It's true, there were certain directors who were absolutely tremendous in radio who just couldn't make the transition.
Well, wouldn't you say that would indicate that radio then was a unique art form?
Well, I suppose one might well apply the term art form to it. I don't think that a good radio actor is in the same class with a brilliant theater actor. I never have.
Mm-hmm.
Alas, radio is a technique. It's a talent. It's a knack, kind of. And it's not easy to achieve, and a lot of people can't do it. One of the interesting, we on Grand Central Station, which I did over and over and over again for 15 years, their policy was to have Broadway actors in Broadway shows, come in and play leads, you know, and then they'd have a radio actor, so-called, working with them. Some of the best theater actors were terrible radio actors. Marlon Brando, with whom I worked on that show, and who, as a matter of fact, was once a student of mine in a speech class.
speaks
well for me, doesn't it?
Yeah. One of your dropouts.
At any rate, Marlon Brando was terrible as a radio actor, and he's a genius. I mean, in my view, he's one of the great, great, greats in the theater. But radio just defeated him.
Let's get back to Pepper Young. Ed, as a matter of fact, if I recall the story at lunch correctly, Mason was involved in a play at the time.
Yes, Lawson Zerbe had the role originally, and he was leaving, and they had to find the replacement, and you almost didn't make it. Could you tell us that story, Mason?
Yes, well, Lawson was leaving the show, and they auditioned every actor, everybody, and they got everybody that they could to audition. Meantime, I had signed a run-of-the-play contract to go to Chicago in a play called Dear Ruth, and in the theater, when you sign a run-of-the-play contract, you're tied up until the following June. To make a long story short, I suddenly received a phone call that I had been chosen to play Pepper Young and to go on the air in a week. And here I was tied up in a run-of-the-play contract in this play, called the producers. And I found out later, they're both nice guys. One of them was Bernie Hart, brother to Moss Hart, and the other guy, I can't remember. They were very severe with me. But they said later, they told friends of mine later, we were going to let him out anyway. But, you know, he shouldn't have done it to us, you know. So they said, well, we'll let you out on one condition. If you get us an actor to replace you, who we feel is right, we'll let you out of the contract. There was an actor with whom I had appeared in a play called Violet who seemed to me to fit the role. I sent him over. They read him. They accepted him. And they released me. Great sighs of relief.
I can
and
imagine.
So I went on to do Pepper Young. And,
well, we're going to depart from your collection tonight, Ed, for at least this excerpt, because, Mason, this is from your collection.
Well, I wish I could call what I have a collection. Unfortunately, what I did, I had some recordings, and those old recordings, as you know, are glass-based. Yeah. And like a fool, I just put them upstairs in the attic, and some of them have deteriorated, some beyond any retrieval. This particular one has a crack in it. But it was a scene between the girl named Diana, or Diane. She was, and I remember the plot line, my parents were very much opposed to this because she had been married, and I think divorced, or perhaps widowed, and B, she was older than I. The part was played by a lovely actress named Rosalind Green. At any rate, I fell in love with Diana, and this is a scene that, a love scene, that you'll hear, with a crack in it.
Okay, we'll listen to that excerpt right after this message.
When looking for that new car, here's a suggestion. Go to Burritt Mutual Savings Bank. No, the Big B does not sell new or used cars, but it does help people to buy them. Chances are that you didn't know that Burritt Mutual Savings Bank will make you a car loan at low, low rates. Before buying that new car, call any of our 5 convenient offices for information. But wait, that's not all. You'll need another car when this one wears out. And the Big B has a plan for that, too. When you finish with your new car loan, keep on making the payments into a Burritt Mutual Savings account where you'll earn big, big dividends with no effort at all. Rates range from 5 to 6% depending on the plan you choose. But whatever the plan, the next car you buy will be paid for by your Burritt Mutual Passbook. So don't wait. Drop in at any office of the Burritt Mutual Savings Bank for your new car loan. Or to make that monthly payment on your old car loan. Burritt Mutual Savings Bank. New Britain, West Hartford, Rocky Hill, and Glastonbury. Member FDIC. You're listening to the Golden Age of Radio with Dick Bertel and the recordings of Ed Corcoran, brought to you by Burritt Mutual Savings Bank, serving Central Connecticut since 1889, and by WTIC.
Pepper Young's Family. The story of your friends, the Youngs, is brought to you by Camay, the mild beauty soap for a smoother, softer complexion.
Am I walk too fast?
Oh, no.
I guess I've got quite a long stride.
Yes, you have got a long stride.
Too long for a little girl like you to keep up with.
Little girl? Oh, I'm not a little girl anymore.
You're awfully little.
Oh, go on, I am not. I can reach up to your shoulder.
I like girls who are little.
It's lucky you do, because you're out with one now.
Look, Diana, this is goofy, and you can stop me if you feel like it, and if you don't want to hear it.
Hear what?
Hear what I'm going to say. You see, do you happen to love me?
Do I? I love you. All my family loves you.
No. You. Just you. Not all your family.
Why, yes, I love you, too. And Tony's crazy about you.
No,
and
this is about you and me, Diana, not about anybody else.
Oh.
Do you feel as if... Well, look, I've got quite a bankroll saved up. I'm a man of property, see? And, gee, Diana, I'm terribly in love with you.
With me? Well, I thought... Oh, Pepper, you can't be in love with me.
Why not? It isn't hard. Have you ever looked in the mirror?
No, I mean, seriously. Pepper, you can't be in love with me. It isn't right. You mustn't be.
I guess it's one of those things I can't help being. Guess the more you tell me I mustn't be, the more I would be, if you know what I mean.
But, Pepper, I'm not the right girl for you.
I'm in love with you. I'm in love with the way you smile and the way you laugh. And I'm in love with that cute curl that comes out under your hat. I want to touch it. I want to twine it around my finger. Does that sound goofy?
Mm-hmm. Pretty goofy.
And I'm in love with your eyes. You have the nicest eyes, Diana. You look at a fellow so squarely. You don't try to flirt or look coy or to kid or something. You just look at a guy, that's all.
Do I?
Yeah. I love your eyes.
You have nice eyes too, Pepper.
No, never mind about me. We're talking about you.
Well, aren't we through?
Through? We haven't even begun. But it's your mouth I like best of all, Diana. It's such a laughing mouth.
Oh, anybody'd laugh at you going on like that.
And when it's serious, I like it too. I like it especially. I'd like to kiss it.
Then why don't you?
Why don't... You mean... Oh, golly, just watch me. Diana, do you mean to say that you felt this way, too?
Mm-hmm. For a long time.
What do you know about that?
But Pepper, I'm older than you.
2 years, that's nothing.
Older in lots of ways.
Well, you're my love, that's who you are. Just forget all the rest. You're my girl and my baby and the one I want to marry.
Pepper, there's Tony. You'll have a son.
I'm nuts about Tony and about his mother and about his aunt.
But Pepper, truly, you don't know much about us. You don't know that we've had an awfully hard life. We didn't have things comfortable the way all of you have. My father, I told you, was a hard man. He married my stepmother right after my mother died, and we had very tough going. It was never the kind of family life that you people have known. Never the sort of father or mother that you have.
Okay, so what? What difference does it make?
Only that I don't know, Pepper. I don't feel I could ever fit into your life, that I could ever belong to your family.
I'll show you how much you belong to my family once you marry me.
Pepper, I don't know what to say.
Just say you love me. That's all you have to say, Diana.
Oh, I do. That's easy. That's the easiest thing of all to say.
Then that's all I want to hear.
But Pepper, your father and mother...
Dad's crazy about you. He thinks you're the grandest person in the world. You don't have to worry about what my father thinks.
But your mother, I know she doesn't want you to care for me.
Well, mother will be a little harder to bring around, but that's only because she doesn't know you.
The Oh, that takes us back to the days of Pepper Young.
You never did get the girl, Onis, when you were just exiting.
On Pepper Young?
Yeah.
No, no, I never married her. I married what the heck is her name of the girl, my wife on Pepper Young. I remember the girls who played them.
How long
Margaret Draper and Linda was my wife. The name of my wife was Linda, that's right.
Just right in and have to worry, you know. Now we can tell them in advance what happened.
Well, the daytime radio soap opera was of one category, but nighttime radio, as we begin to get the picture through our series of interviews, Ed, was a step above, and certainly Theater Guild of the Air was on top of the heap.
Yes, Theater Guild of the Air was an hour-long show. It was a real prestige show. They had Hollywood stars that appeared on it. I remember I had experiences on that show that I remember with great fondness. They had Lunton Fontanne on once, and I played a newsboy, a Cockney newsboy. I had one line and was delighted to have had it. I had to say, you know, come and get your paper here, come and get your paper. And during the read-through, after the read-through, I happened to be sitting next to Miss Fontanne, and she patted me on the knee and she said, "You have a wonderful Cockney accent. You know, Alfred could never do accents." That was my, you know, this was the kind of a lady that she was, you know, with my one little line. Well, I remember this show of Alice Adams, I remember very vividly, because Judy Garland was, of course, had already established herself as a great star, but she had been through great personal troubles. And this was, she appeared here on this particular show after a suicide attempt, the marks were still visible on her wrists. But one of the things that struck us all was when we came into the studio to have the first reading, we started reading. There were other actors on. I don't remember which ones they were, but they were on other soap operas like Road of Life or Winnegar. And she'd say, "Wait a minute, you're Pepper Young. You're the such and such character." She was a greater fan in a way. She was a fan of all the people with whom she was working, which was, of course, very refreshing to all of us. And working with her, I'm delighted that you have this recording, because I don't know how many years ago was it done?
I would say around 1951 or 52, my guess.
As long ago as that, but I remember vividly the experience of working with her.
Well, can you set the scene for us, Ed?
Well, Pepper. I'm all caught up here today. Mason, he's out of character here. Pepper was kind of a benign individual, I thought. You know, this character here is a little more lively, let's say, and he's Judy Garland's younger brother. And he has to take it to a dance, and that's about where we will open up. And incidentally, I think you'll all notice that Judy has an exceptionally beautiful voice. You never really appreciate it until you hear on radio what a great voice she had. Okay. So here's the excerpt from Alice Adams on Theater Guild on the Air.
What? Who said I was going to take her tonight?
Oh, but Walter.
Don't water me, Ma. Well, I'm just as likely to take Alice to that dance at Mildred Palmer's as I am to eat a couple of barrels of broken glass. I'm no society snake.
But, Walter, I told you a week ago, and I've laid out your dress suit.
No, sir, no, sir. Here's one member of this family who don't kid himself. I know who my friends are and where I belong. I got a date downtown. I ain't going to break it.
No, no, you can't do this, Walter. You can't. It's more than I can bear to see her disappointed when she's planned it for days.
Look, Ma, why hasn't somebody asked her to go? She ought to be that popular anyhow. Why does she run around with that crowd if she's not good enough for them?
You don't understand how hard things are for her and how brave she is about them. Or you couldn't be so selfish. You couldn't.
Oh, rats. But it's the last time.
Alice?
Yes, Mother?
Come in. Your brother will be glad to take you, dear.
Yes. He certainly sounded thrilled.
Ladies' dressing room upstairs.
This is charming decor, Walter. Such delightful colors.
Oh, rats.
Why, Margot, how positively chic you look.
Thanks, Alice. Oh, there's the music.
Organ name? Maybe I'm wrong.
What's she mean?
Nothing. Walter, do you know that this circular ballroom is an authentic Queen Anne copy? Imagine
it. Relax. Nobody's even looking at you. Well, come on. I suppose you want to dance.
No. First, we must speak to Mildred and to Mr. and Mrs. Palmer.
I haven't got anything to say to
Walter,
them.
Oh, Walter, please, can't you ever make believe? Come on.
Mildred, dear, such a success.
Good evening, Alice.
I knew you'd wear chiffon, dear, and your curls. You'll look too fabulously.
You know my mother and father, I think.
Good evening. So nice you could come.
Thank you, Mrs. Palmer. This is my brother, Walter.
Oh, so nice.
Pleasure, young man.
How you doing? Colonel Flint, Daddy.
Oh, Colonel, so nice. You must tell us about what...
My hand got chilblains. Well, let's give it a whirl. Hey, at least the music's good. Hey, that band of Slapsy Sam and his Senders. Hiya, Sam.
Hey, Kate, what you doing up here?
It's the big time, huh, Sam?
Walter.
Hey, Alice, you're quite a stepper.
Well, truthfully, there isn't a man in this room that dances as well as you, Walter. But the mystery is how you ever learned it.
Don't you worry about me. I get around. What you, Alice? On the level, where does all this get you? Why, if Mildred Palmer's your best friend, I'll eat...
Walter?
Okay.
Is it so hard to understand, Walter? I like all this. I like the way they do things. The clothes and the talk. Everything right. Nothing's scrimped or cheap-looking. It's sort of my dream. It makes me feel as if I had wings.
Some explanation leads me right back where I started. Well, I'll see you later.
But you won't be too long.
Look, I done my duty, didn't I? Now you're on your own.
Alice, would you mind if we took this chair?
Well, Margot, I...
Well, you're not using both of them, are you, dear?
No, I'm expecting someone. I'll wait over there. Excuse me. Oh, Mildred.
This is my cousin, Arthur Russell.
Oh,
he wants to ask you for this dance.
If I may have the pleasure, Miss Adams. A wonderful band.
Isn't it?
A wonderful party.
Fine.
You're not very talkative, are you?
Usually, yes.
Well, then why not now?
Well, why should I inflict that on you, too? You've done your duty, Mr. Russell.
My duty?
Of course. I suppose Mildred brought you over because I wasn't dancing. That was sweet of her.
Oh, you've got it backwards. Mildred wanted me to dance with some of the others, and I said I would if she'd introduce me to you first.
You asked?
Yes. I saw you a while ago. You were dancing beautifully with a chap, the best couple on the floor.
That was my brother, Walter.
Oh, really? Then you were talking to him, and, well, your eyes were sort of shining for a moment, all lit up.
My... Oh, Mr. Russell, you think of these things much too quickly.
Think? No, I'm just saying what I saw. Oh. Well, I wish we could dance this next together, but I suppose we're both booked up. Where's your next? Do you see him anywhere?
Well, as a matter of fact, I promised to sit the next one out.
Well, then perhaps later?
If you'd like to.
Oh, indeed, I would. I'll look for you.
Thank you. Oh, I wonder if you could do me a favor.
Of course.
Would you see if you can find my brother, Walter, for me? He may be in the smoking room or somewhere, if it isn't too much trouble.
No, not a bit.
He saw me. He asked for me.
Here he comes, Miss Adams.
Oh, thank you. I know this disappearing brother of mine must have been terribly hard to find.
Oh, on the contrary, it was easy.
Well, Mildred will probably never forgive me for keeping you away so long.
Oh, it was a pleasure. So long, Adams.
Walter,
don't you ever do that again, do you understand?
Do what?
Send anyone looking for me.
Well, he found you, didn't he?
Yeah, he found me, all right. You want to know where? I was shooting craps with a checkroom boy.
Our guest tonight here on the Golden Age of Radio is Mason Adams, perhaps better known to some of you old-time radio fans as Pepper Young. Mason, during that last year that Pepper Young was on the family, was on the air. During that last year, you were perhaps one of the most active people at NBC.
Well, there were still a fair number of shows left on the networks, although they were beginning, the number of them was beginning to diminish. But one of my favorite shows, and one that stayed on for quite a long time, was a show called My True Story, which I used to do a lot. It was on five times a week, so it was a great playground for all of us radio actors. I remember one funny thing happened one morning on that particular show. I was playing a heavy, a real mean character, which I was pretty good. Mm-hmm. Ask my kids, I'm terrific at it now. And after the show went off the air, the phone rang, and there was a call from a lady down south. And she said, I just want to make every kind of complaint I can about what you're doing to that. Now, I know that fella you have playing that mean man is Pepper Young, and he's nice, and you shouldn't have him play mean characters like that. I don't believe it for a minute, and it's just wrong of you to do it. That was one thing. Once on Grand Central Station, I played a character. A call came through, an emergency call from somewhere like Dubuque, Iowa. A station manager had a call from a woman. These shows were broadcast live then, you understand, who insisted that I was her long-lost son. I had to get on the telephone, talk to the lady, tell her who I was, and that indeed, alas and unhappily, I wasn't. Things like this happened, you know, quite frequently. People really believed. Yeah, but even today, I mean, Santos Ortega, whom you know, plays an old man on one of the television soap operas.
As the world turns, I believe.
As the world turns, and I understand every time he has a birthday, he gets dozens of presents. Mm-hmm. I mean, the character does, Grandpa Snapper, whoever it is that he plays. People really, you know, they believe and get involved.
Well, speaking of getting involved, Mason, you're going to get involved in this next characterization. This is an excerpt from a program called The Carrington Playhouse, and it's built around the radio writer, Elaine Carrington, about whom we talked earlier. And this was a program that was on Mutual, and as I understand the format of it, they invited young neophyte writers to submit scripts, and they would be performed on the air. And tonight's script, called Design for Murder, was written by Ralph Klein, who happens to be the general manager of WRYM right here in Hartford. So let's listen to you as we hear Design for Murder from the Carrington Playhouse.
The Mutual Broadcasting System presents the Carrington Playhouse. Mutual Coast to Coast presents the Carrington Playhouse, the eighth in a series of programs featuring dramas by author new to radio and produced by one of radio's most distinguished personalities and successful writers, Elaine Carrington. And now, here is Mrs. Carrington.
Thank you and good evening. The author of tonight's Playhouse is Ralph Klein. He was born in Hartford, Connecticut, and he's 32 years old. Of himself, he says, I made my entrance into radio several years ago by writing scripts for a local station. There was very little money in it. Therefore, in 1940, I turned to the more profitable field of writing advertising copy. I was extended an invitation to be in the Army in 1942 and served for 3 years in this country and abroad with 106th Infantry. When I heard about the Carrington Playhouse, I decided to try my hand once again at script writing. Design for Murder is my first writing effort in over 6 years, and that's a long time. End of quote. I think Ralph Klein will prove by tonight's tense and dramatic story that he not only has a future in script writing, but that he also has a most original and ingenious mind for building a murder mystery. But I'll let you judge that for yourselves when you hear the play we are now about to present on the Playhouse stage. The star of tonight's performance is Mason Adams, who, in my opinion, is one of the finest young actors in radio.
The Carrington Playhouse presents Design for Murder.
My name is Bill Davis. Yep, I'm the same Bill Davis you've heard so many times on your all-night record program over your local radio station. Remember how you've tuned in on me when you couldn't sleep nights and you listened to the music of your favorite band? Yeah, that's me, Bill Davis. Got a story to tell you. Haven't much time to tell it, but here goes.
At the sound of the musical note, the time will be exactly 1 a.m.
Now your all-night record show is on the air. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. With the strains of Benny Goodman's Let's Dance, this is Bill Davis, your all-night record man, here to bring you 5 straight hours of popular music on record. Yes, folks, from now until 6 a.m., you're going to hear all your favorite music played and sung by your favorite recording artists. But before our program gets underway, I have a favor to ask of you. Please do not telephone your requests to the station. And now on with record number one tonight, a brand new platter by that lovely blonde songstress now appearing at the Club Cascade, Terry Taylor, my wife. But don't hold against Terry the fact that she's married to a mug like me. So here it is, Moments With You, sung by Mrs. Bill Davis. Terry Taylor, to you.
Moments with you make me know this is real.
A record jockey gets plenty of time to think between announcements. Too much time. I like to talk about Terry and myself whenever I played one of her records. But that was at the beginning of her career. Now I had another reason for plugging Terry. I wanted to build us up as a devoted couple. I wanted to divert suspicion from me when they found her body. Everything I said about her was part of my design for murder, because I was going to kill the one person I loved most in the world. I don't exactly know how or when it all began. We were so happy. We were so much in love. And then suddenly she skyrocketed to fame. Al Gordon picked her to sing with his band at his Club Cascade. I'd been waiting for her to get a break like that. But somehow the first night I saw her there at the Club Cascade, instead of being glad for her, instead of being proud of her, something inside of me turned to stone. The minute she spotted me, she made a beeline for the table where I was sitting. And she said,
"Oh, darling, I'm so glad you're here."
"Yeah, I'm here."
"Well, tell me, was I all right? Did they like me?"
"You're okay."
"What did I do wrong, Bill? You've got to tell me. It doesn't matter what the others think about my singing as long as you don't like it."
"Who said I didn't like it?"
"Oh, darling, I can tell."
"Hey, Bill, wasn't Terry terrific?"
"Oh, you know Al Gordon, Bill."
"Sure, I know him."
"Yeah, hello."
"Bill doesn't like something about the way I sang that last song."
"He doesn't? Why, you wowed him, honey. You wrapped him up and took him home. How much better can you be?"
"If Bill thinks I can be better, I can be better."
"You're out of this world, baby, and don't let any green-eyed husband tell you different."
Got around town how nuts Al Gordon was about his singing star, Terry Taylor. The gossip columns picked it up. Even Joe over at the station kidded me about it. And I had all those long hours at night and in the early morning to think, just to think and wonder and figure out if Terry and Al were together sitting at a table at his nightclub in the car, driving her home at the door when she put her key in the lock. Well, that's what was really in my heart. Murder. I was planning to kill her. I was trying to figure out an angle, a design for murder I could get away with. They hang people in this state for murder, and I didn't like the thought of a rope around my neck. I had to work out an alibi, some way of proving I was somewhere else at the time of the murder. The idea came one night after I read. The correct time is now 3:15 a.m., and this is your all-night record man, Bill Davis, with a great big pile of your favorite music to be played from now until 6 o'clock. Right now, here's a favorite of yours and mine, Full Moon and Empty Arms.
Hey, I'm going to go out for my coffee now, Bill.
See you later.
Joe Rice, my engineer in the control room, was like a railroad timetable. He did everything on schedule. Every morning at exactly 3:15, he'd head for Mac's restaurant up the street for coffee and sandwiches. While he was gone, I'd play my own records on the turntable in the studio, and here's the funny part of it. When he returned, I knew without looking at the clock that it was 3:29. Never 3:28, always 3:29, just in time for the 3:30 station identification. That's how exacting Joe was in his movements. And in the dozens of schemes I thought of for killing Terry, I never dreamed that the one I'd finally use would involve Joe in a split-second timing. Right then it hit me. Transcription. How can a man be in two places at one time by means of transcription recording? If I could be broadcasting my program as usual by means of transcription and at the same time be visiting Terry, it was an idea. The best yet. But I had to think. Yes, it needed a lot of thought and planning. This was it, no doubt about it. But I had to go slow, take my time, think out every single angle so there'd be no slip-ups. Joe Rice left the station every morning at precisely 3:15. He returned at precisely 3:29, 14 minutes. Suppose I prepared a special transcription to put on the air during that time. Could I make it home, kill Terry, and get back to the station in 14 minutes?
Be a payday saver at the Big B. Burritt Mutual Savings Bank. Come into any office of Burritt on the first day, last day, 15th day, or any day of the month, and you'll meet a select group of savers, the payday savers, businessmen, tradesmen, professional people, career girls, and even mothers who save from the grocery money. Why do these people all stop in at the Big B? to save on a regular and very profitable basis. A payday saver is a regular saver, a saver who knows that only through a systematic plan of savings will he be able to pay for that college education, that new home or retirement trip around the world. At the Burritt, the payday saver receives 5% on a regular account with interest from day of deposit to day of withdrawal, 6% on 2-year certificates of deposit, 5.75% on 1-year certificates, and 5.25% on 90-day notice accounts. Join your friends at the sign of the Big B, the Burritt Mutual Savings Bank, with offices in New Britain, West Hartford, Rocky Hill, and Glastonbury. Become a payday saver. Deposits insured by FDIC.
Mason, I'm curious as to when you began your career as a commercial spokesman. Now, this was relatively recent, in the 50s?
Yeah, it was sometime in the 50s. When I began to realize that radio wasn't going to stay around, I looked for another way to earn a living. I figured shoe salesman. those of us who worked as radio actors were faced with various alternatives. Some of my colleagues went out to California and became, you know, Carl Swenson and Jim Bowles, other actors.
Frank Lovejoy
well. Moved out to the coast and worked in films. Other actors went into the soap operas. Other actors gave up the business. And some of us became commercial announcers, and which is what I did. I consciously made an effort to move into the field and happily was able to.
And you did it at a time when announcers were still very prominent in that field, because yours is not an announcer's voice.
That's
yours
right.
Is more of a, I suppose there's a technical term for it, but a character.
Conversational, voice. I yeah. think. I was one of the, among the people who pioneered the conversational, easy approach to commercials, I guess you might say. Mm. And now it's generally accepted.
Ed, you've been anxious to say something all evening here.
Ever since Mason agreed to appear, I've been thinking about this, but on the radio, as Pepper Young, you know, he was in a series of situations where things are always going wrong, and he had to straighten them out, but in real life, he's in one jam after another.
Okay.
I like it. That's a very good
You're going to send that to the
Smuckers.
All right. We'll take you out of here now, Ed. You know, we've run out of time, and Mason Adams, it's been great fun getting together with you. Thanks so much for sharing your career and some of your excerpts.
Yeah, what we do without them.
The pleasure has been entirely mine. Thank you, Dick. Thank you, Ed, for inviting me.
Until next time, this is Dick Bertel.
This is Ed Cochran.
Good night.
The Golden Age of Radio with Dick Bertel and the recordings of Ed Cochran has been brought to you by WTIC and by Burritt Mutual Savings Bank, serving Central Connecticut since 1889. Be sure to hear the next Golden Age of Radio broadcast Thursday, May 24th, when our guest will be sound effects wizard Hamilton O'Hara. With location engineering and technical assistance by Bob Sharago, the Golden Age of Radio is produced and edited by Brian Hartnett. This is Al Terzi.
Pepper Young's Family. The story of your friends, the Youngs, is brought to you by Cam-Aid.
Rinse-O-White and Rinse-O-Bright.